Thanks for tuning in. You're about to listen to a conversation between authors Ryan Butter and Shankari Chandran as they discuss Shankari's latest book, Safe Haven. This recording was made in front of a live audience in the Henry Carmichael Theatre at the Sydney Mechanics School of Arts, which is located on Gadigal land.
I just finished reading Safe Haven last week, so it's still very fresh in my mind. I think it'll stay with me for quite a while, the characters. And it made me think about people that come to Australia in different ways, migrants and the refugee experience. Because I think when people migrate, they lose something. Some things they choose to leave behind. Other things are taken from them when they get here. And other things just slip away naturally. And I think that this book invites readers to think about all those different experiences and what's lost and what's gained when people come to Australia. And so I want to try to explore those themes today. I'm going to ask some questions about the book, without any spoilers. But first of all, what I'd like to do, for those that haven't read the book, is maybe you could just give us a little overview of what takes place in Safe Haven.
Thank you. Thanks, Ryan. I describe Safe Haven as a love story and a murder mystery set on an offshore detention centre. It has a nun, Sister Fina, who is facing, she's Sri Lankan, and she's facing the threat of imminent deportation. There is a community in Western New South Wales who loves her and is rising up to protect her. And there is an investigator, a federal investigator, who is sent to the offshore detention centre to investigate the suspicious death of a border security guard. So that's the setup of the novel. It explores the themes of dispossession, of seeking refuge, and for me in particular, the power and the strength of communities to take a stand against what they know to be wrong.
Thank you for that. It gives a good... I assume most people have read the book here? No?
It's okay if you haven't. There's no judgment, but we'll try not to do any story spoilers.
So I'll get the bamboo slithers on all of you for that. I want to go first to a really powerful sort of theme that you draw out in the book, and you capitalise this. It's the not knowing. And Shankari writes about when these people are held in detention, is their future is not known, and the boredom that comes with that, the fear that comes with that. And you write that death in a war zone is preferable to the not knowing when they're there. And I just wanted, like, in the writing of this book, you're putting yourself into that space of these people. Can you talk through what conclusions you came to about that not knowing and almost like a form of torture that these people are going through?
Yeah. So I think firstly I'd say when you put yourself into the space, someone else's space, I think all of us try to do that as writers. And at the same time, there are limitations to that, right? It's our imagination, it's the robustness and rigor of our research. And at the same time, we will never be there unless we're writing from our own lived experience. And so that process of writing becomes very much a process of trying to understand, to feel, reflect, and honor the lived experience and the survival of extraordinary people. And that's the writer's challenge. And, you know, I think you do it beautifully in your work, Ryan, and I hope that in this book, because these people are so vulnerable and so marginalised and so invisibilised through that process of offshore detention, that it was really important to me to try to sit in that not knowing for them and with them and then describe it. And so I think in the book I talk about the way in which the horrors that they are fleeing in their home countries are profoundly terrible. Right? If you think about the average Sri Lankan Tamil refugee, anywhere between the height of the war, even to this day when they're leaving Sri Lanka, they're leaving because they're terrified for themselves and for their families. And it may be a choice to get on a boat and risk your life and your children's life, but it really isn't a choice. And yet at the same time, they are hoping and yearning for something better. And when they come here and then are faced with a system that is deliberately impossible to navigate and placed on a place in a place, in a center that is deliberately out of sight. The concept of indefinite detention, right? Really think about those words, indefinite detention. It goes on and on and on and on. And they do not know what the resolution will be, if any or if ever. And in many cases, for those that can't communicate properly with the external world, they don't know what has happened to the people they've left behind, and they don't know if the people they've left behind knows what's happened to them. Now, I remember losing my third child for 20 minutes. I should have framed that sentence better. I really should have framed that better, and I apologise. He went missing at a sort of food festival, as they do, for 20 minutes. And it was possibly the worst 20 minutes of my life. I mean, I couldn't even speak in the end to describe what he looked like to the St. John's sort of team of people. And you think, this is what people are enduring every day for days, weeks, months and years. And it's impossible to imagine. To your point, how does one imagine it? It's impossible to imagine, but you try. We all try as writers to imagine and to then honour and give words to these experiences.
And that not knowing, is that a deliberate tactic from the Australian government to have people give up, or not the ones that are here, maybe deter the ones that do come or thinking of coming? Is it a deliberate?
Yeah, it's a deliberate deterrent. It's an absolute deliberate deterrent, you know, because we as a sort of civilised nation can't do anything worse than indefinite detention, right? Other measures, punitive measures, are no longer on the table unless we wish to deteriorate into a country that, and there are many countries like that that don't respect the rule of law. So really the worst thing that we can do, short of sending them back, which is the ultimate aspiration, is to hold them indefinitely. And in the recent High Court case, they effectively said that indefinite detention that is not for punitive purposes is actually punishment, and that the executive government cannot create laws in that manner, and that is for the judiciary to make laws in that manner, because indefinite is so punishing. And so it was it's an interesting judgment. We won't go down into the judgment just because all the lawyers in the room will completely nerd out. But it is intended to disincentivize. It is intended to deter, to frighten, and to stop.
It's. I think you give a really good sense of that. Like I said, it feels in the book like a form of torture to have these people locked up with no communication, with no knowing of what's going to come. The other thing you do really well in the book is you show us many sides of Sri Lankan people that come to Australia. And it would be easy of just to go down the one route and have one Sri Lankan character, but you give lots of Sri Lankan characters and lots of people from other areas as well, but you focus on the Sri Lankan characters. And there's the ones that are experiencing the not knowing, but then there are also the lucky ones. And maybe the protagonist, second protagonist, Lucky, is one of the lucky ones. And I assumed reading it reading some of your backstory that your family, you may consider your family lucky ones that came by choice before the wars started in Sri Lanka. And I wonder, when you're writing that story, is there a sense of duty? As one of the lucky ones, is there, not guilt, but is there a sense of duty to those that didn't have that choice that you had and having being able to speak up for them? Because I also think when people migrate, and I assume this is the case with your family, they're looking for a new start or a better opportunity. But can you just have a new start, or do you feel that obligation to the people who didn't have that opportunity or who now come under different circumstances?
Yeah. Thank you. That's a really beautiful question. And I'm going to try not to look at my cousin, the poet Christine Shimister, who's over there, just because otherwise I'll start crying with that question, because it's a really, I think it's a question that is a big part of our lives. We are the lucky generation, and it feels like such a trite thing to say that we're lucky, and yet we are lucky. And I think about that good fortune on a regular basis, and not in a way that is burdensome to me, but in a way that is a privilege and a platform that our family gave us, and that results in a sense of responsibility and a duty to do something with that privilege. And so it's possible to have both things. It's possible to come and have a new start, which we got, and at the same time to feel that sense of responsibility to the people that were not as fortunate to get that new start. And, you know, there's, I don't know if you know the author Yumna Kassab. She's, Yumna Kassab wrote Politica, and she wrote The Lovers. And The Lovers, in that, she talks about how not every migration is the same. And I think this is where, for example, the migrant story can often, they can all just be conflated into one. One story, one sort of nebulous mass of migrants that are sort of vaguely non-white and sort of undefined complexity to their migration. Whereas actually, writers love the detail, and I think the greatest writers are those that are attentive to the detail and are respectful of the detail and see it and are willing to have a go at giving words to it. And as Yumna Kassab says, not every migration is the same. And for those of us that migrated before the war, our lives are incredibly different to those that migrated when the war started, during the war, at its brutal end, and then afterwards. And we had this, we were given a fulsome life, education, the opportunity to work. Our lives, our children were safe. We were not completely disrupted and destroyed by war. Instead, we watched that war from the diaspora, from the safety of the diaspora, from the safety of a first world country with a liberal democracy that respects the rule of law. And we watched our ancestral homeland fall apart and people suffer enormous loss. And so that does drive my storytelling. And I hope in a way that doesn't burden the reader, but invites them into that world which has struggle and it has pain and it has challenges, but it also has laughter and it has beauty and pride and culture and great food and, you know, annoying relatives. It has all the things. It has all the things of life. And so I want you to come into that world with me.
It's definitely not a burden. And I sent you a message a few weeks back. There's a lot of comedy, a lot of humour in your writing. One thing that just jumps to mind is you're talking about in Tamil households, the pressure cooker is just a time bomb waiting to go off. And but you write about some really dark things, and then all of a sudden there's this spurt of humour in there. And I suppose it was going to be a later question. We're going to jump onto it now. When you're writing, because you know, you're writing about what goes on in these sort of refugee camps back in Sri Lanka, and again, but then a couple of pages along, there's some sort of laugh out loud bit of humour from the characters and dialogue. Is that an intentional tactic, or is that a response or like a defence mechanism for the reader, for you, when you're writing? Or is it you just want to reflect life? Because life is, it's tragedy, but in sometimes in tragedy, you know, in hospitals or UN workers, dark humour is a really important coping mechanism. How are you using humour or seeing that?
In the latter, the third way, I'd love to think that I was clever enough to be contrived about it. But actually, life is all those things, right? In the darkest of times, people just have really inappropriate senses of humour, and it's really great. And I think each culture has its own kind of inappropriate humour that we share amongst ourselves, and then a degree of that is exposed, you know, in what's called mixed company, and then a degree of that I might foolishly then publish in a novel that then gets read more widely. And so actually, it's from observation. It's not an intentional juxtaposition of levity with darkness. It's observation of life and from life that then when I go back to the editing process, I see what's happened. I see that there are these really dark moments, and then suddenly, even in the scene where Sister Fina is forcibly removed from her, from the Nightingale Inn, from the home that she's made with a beautiful family. She's removed from the home, and you know, there are these sort of big ABF, Australian Border Force guys, who are with their batons and they're dragging her away. And then Clinton from next door comes out in his boxers and his cricket bat, and he's ready. And his dogs, his cavoodles are attacking, and it's, and you know, and at that point in the editorial process, I then will sit down with my editor and trust them to say to me, actually, you're breaking tone at this point, and so we need to pull it back, or that this segment here is okay because it gives the reader the respite, the emotional respite that they need as a reader and that I need as a writer. Because I think, you know, and I know we'll talk about genre later on, but it's possible to create and understandable to create a novel about an offshore detention centre that is entirely bleak from the prologue to the very end, because it is bleak. And at the same time, if I want the reader to stay with me when I get to that editorial process, because the first draft is just, there's no consciousness to it, right? The first draft is just, it just comes out. When I go back to editing, then I'm constructing, creating, and I'm thinking about you, and I'm thinking about me, and I'm thinking about the journey that we are going to go on together, and how do I keep you with me? And that's where there is a greater consciousness to literary technique and to tone, to style, to humour.
Well, it's done very well, and it feels natural, as in a life sort of happens that way, and I really enjoyed the humour there. At some point, Sister Fina, the main character, she's in Australia on a safe haven visa, and that comes with obligations to behave, basically, if I can put it. It's a bit more detail on that, but she doesn't. She sees something which she doesn't agree with, and she speaks out, and it causes the visa to be revoked. I think I'm spoiling too much to say that. But it goes to the heart of, I think we have a notion in Australia that refugees should be grateful. And if they dare not be grateful, then it's like, well, you know, the classic go back to where you came from if you don't like it. And it's such a damaging thought process, because yes, I'm sure they are very grateful. They've been a new start of life, etc. But it's also very traumatic for them. It's very difficult for them. And I don't think accepting that visa forfeits your right to speak out about what you disagree with. And so, and I've spoken to other refugees that have come in and said, oh, we don't want to say anything because of the visa situation. What does that say about us as a country, that we accept these people, but on really strict conditions? Like, we'll let you in, but don't criticise me.
Yeah, I think that... Well, for starters, many countries are the same, right? Although what I've written is based in Australia, it's an offshore detention centre, which is something that, you know, a concept that Australia is now exporting to England and other countries. They're all learning from us and setting up their own offshore programs. But at the same time, this is a universal issue, migration, the forced dispossession. And it will, with climate change and escalating war, only get worse, right? There will be more and more people moving, fleeing, and needing to go somewhere else. And so in the case of what does it say about Australia, it's what it says about everywhere, which is that we have this concept of conditionality to the kind of refuge that we are willing to offer to people. And it's always a funny one, isn't it? Or not funny, haha, but an interesting one, in that you think, well, do you have certain rights because you're a refugee and you forfeit certain rights? Or how about we go back to basics and say, well, we're actually all human beings, and therefore we all have a set of fundamental human rights, which are set out in, you know, sort of 10 to 50 documents to maybe 200 now. And none of those rights are rocket science. They're actually really self-evident. And everyone is entitled to them, regardless of your nationality, regardless of your immigration status. How about we do that? But we often allow ourselves to go down that conversation of conditionality, of being here on probation, of being forced to be grateful. And I completely understand why, and I'm very much a part of that conversation myself. But every now and then I like to do that sense check that just goes, actually, human rights are called human rights for a reason. They're called universal for a reason. And it's not illegal to seek asylum. It's perfectly legal to seek asylum any which way you can seek asylum. And so how about we start there?
Yeah, it's a good point. I think the human rights have splintered into these particular identity group rights, I suppose. And sometimes we forget, if we go back to the top, they're human rights, we're all human and they all apply.
There's no class system in human rights. It's actually, it's not a tiered system, it's a universal system. And it's very easy to be distracted from that.
Yeah, I think it's played upon as well by certain sectors of politics. In the book, Sisyphina says that people never recover from the trauma of war. That, you know, those memories are with them all the time and they bring that with them. And it made me think that when we're accepting or when refugees seek refuge here in Australia, rather than us accepting them, but when they seek refuge here, we have an expectation of them that's kind of unfair. And I think in Australia we have the migrant success story, and that you come here, you contribute, you're part of society. And it just seems that to apply that to refugees, it's unfair in a certain way, because they're still those people that went through that trauma. And I just wonder how much... We're trying to do something compassionate and humanitarian on bringing in or accepting refugees. How much are we contributing to actually worsening that situation for those people, the detention centres? Because it's almost that, you know, you have to contribute here, you have to do this. Surely just accepting these people is enough. And that should be, kind of goes to the previous question, what can we do more to be compassionate? Because it's all like we accepting them, that's how that it ends there. But these people are going through immense trauma. And maybe also the flip side from those people seeking here, and you write about people who come to Australia dreaming, I'm going to go to Australia, I'm going to have a new life, but they get here and they're still the same person with those same traumas. So what can we do better in that sense?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, right, in what you've just asked me. God, Ryan.
Sorry.
And
it got me thinking, this book got me thinking a lot about, never didactic, never hitting me over the head, but it just sort of stayed with me thinking about how we treat people as humans.
So I think one of the things that I really struggle with myself, and I think a lot of you know what's called migrant communities are the same, and I use that sort of bunny ears expression because really, genuinely, I think there is a legitimate school of thought that says we're all migrants. We've been here for no more than 235 years. We are all migrants except First Nations people. It's just that some of our waves of migration happened later than others post that sort of 1788. And there, the thing that I struggle with is this sense of wanting to be the good migrant. And I think we expect that of the refugee as well. We have expectations that they will be the good refugee, the good asylum seeker, that they will come here, they'll somehow perform better than the average citizen. And that they're held to a higher standard. And when I say I struggle with this, I do, because I want to almost effectively overperform, right? I want to make it clear that, you know, me and my family have come here through hardship and we're doctors and we're lawyers and we're contributing, and isn't that wonderful? Whereas actually, you know, my neighbour, Jackie, has none of that on her shoulders. She just, you know, if she can take out the trash on time, that's... she's winning at life. So, and I think we do that to asylum seekers as well. We have these expectations and aspirations for them, whereas their aspirations, sure, they want a better life, but they're also just trying to survive, right? They're literally, in some cases, trying to keep their head above water and bring their children with them. And so where we set those aspirations is unfair to begin with. And then I think... you know, there are, I would almost challenge what you're saying in that so much of safe haven is about exactly what you're asking, which is what else can we do? So much of safe haven is about communities around Australia that do so much for asylum seekers. And so I know that in this book it feels like it's an interrogation of the sort of, and in fact it is, it's an interrogation of the injustices and the traumas inflicted by the detention centre. But it is also, for me, firstly and lastly, an exploration of the power of community. So it was based on a community in Apollo Bay and the Biloela community and communities around Australia that are part of Rural Australians for Refugees, who are largely a group of grandmothers, like a national network of grandmothers, who write to asylum seekers in detention, send them care packages, connect them with lawyers and wraparound services, help them navigate the migration system, and then help them start in life when they are finally released from detention. And I really wanted, because when I look at asylum, at our policies of indefinite detention and the things that our politicians do and say, I think, well, who are you speaking to? Like, who are these policies targeting? Who is it that's voting for you on the basis of these policies? Because I've been introduced to all these other Australians who think that that's rubbish and who know that it's inhumane and are calling it out and are wanting to do better. And so a lot of Safe Haven is about actually really elevating their voices.
You've answered my rest of my questions, which was about the community.
That's all we've got time for.
I am getting onto the community, don't worry. I didn't miss that in my reading. I will go there now because I do have those questions about that because...
I'm just here to mess with your carefully structured questions.
No. I had so many. I won't get through them all, don't worry. But I remember... in the mid-90s when the wars in Kosovo were happening, and I'm from a little town in the Hunter Valley. It's a coal mining town, and we received people from Kosovo. They were fleeing the war, and I think it happened in a few places around Australia, but they were housed with locals, and they put some up at the army camp, and people took them into their house and were billeted. And it was, like, amazing to see that. But at the same time, that community was also voting for John Howard and the policies, and you explore really well. I really loved what you did here with the community of Hastings because you showed that love. They had these. There was a community that receives refugees, helps them get back on their feet, and they're part of the community. And you can really sense that, and you can sense that you've experienced that, and you've seen that, and there's that love there. And then what it made me think, as someone from a small community who has seen that, but has also seen the politics, which are completely... And you could have someone who has a refugee in their home talking about, yeah, we need to stop the boats. Yeah. And there's this dichotomy, and I think it happens a lot in Australia. A couple of weeks back, I was in Ballarat, and there's a group down there called the Ballarat Afghan Action Group. And they're all, I'd say they're all over 80 years old. And I said, oh, like, you know, what Afghans are you working with here in the community? I expect they must have been receiving refugees. And they said, oh, no, we fund a school for girls in Afghanistan and we support food aid. We send food aid. They work with middlemen in Pakistan to get food into Afghanistan. They're senior citizens in Ballarat. There's this immense love and passion to do something like that, but it's not reflected in the politics because Labor isn't that different from... Liberals on immigration. Sorry to ask you. How do you explain that?
I hate those kind of questions. It's a real race to the bottom, isn't it, with both parties on that one. And look, you know, again, no judgment in terms of who you vote for or why you vote, right? It's your business. For me, the issue is around compassion and that question, that contradiction. And in fact, I think I put it in my author's note, Ryan, if you got as far as the end, you'll see that I said that this book was responding to the contradiction of Australia, or I'm sure there are many contradictions in Australia, and this is one
of them. I was hoping you'd solve it for me.
There are so many, right? Why? Who are these politicians speaking to? How is it that we vote for them and those policies, and at the same time are capable of such extraordinary generosity of spirit? And I think sometimes with writing, all writers can do is to remind us of the ways in which we are our best selves, because it's really easy to be one's worst self. I reckon I'm probably 80-20, 90-10 maybe, 90 my worst self in the course of any given day, 10% my best self. And I think that writing, literature, can really lift you and show you what the best of humanity is possible, which is not to say that it's motherhood and apple pie, it's not to say that it's delusional or looks away, because it's really important to me that literature looks straight and front on at the horrors that we inflict upon ourselves and each other, and it's really important to me that readers do the same, but at the same time, in looking at the horror, remember our potential for greatness. So I don't have an answer for you, but I do have tried very hard with this novel, more so than any other, to document that contradiction and to remember the best.
I think that's the power of the book, is that it urges us towards that. that hope and that love and that compassion. And because it would have been very easy, as you said, to write a bleak novel about detention, but you chose to include this sort of yin and yang, this amazing love from that community. There was a review in The Guardian, and it said the book and your stories contain shame and hope. And ultimately what the community does isn't successful in your book, without giving too much away. Maybe I did, sorry. And so I want to talk about, you know, those choices as an author, because it's, as you say, it's important to show that love and community compassion, but in this case it doesn't win through. And I know it was sort of loosely based on the Bilawila family, in which case it did win. Why that choice?
So, thanks for almost giving it away and then not. That was skillfully done.
Took them to the edge.
You did.
And then we brought them back.
You did. I was like, looking...
I think books are for sale out the front on your way out.
I was looking right over the precipice into the story spoiler. So why that particular authorial choice? Because I think we've seen in recent times things happening both ways, right? We've seen the Bilawila family returned to their home in Bilawila, but we've seen plenty of people forcibly deported. And I didn't want to present a false narrative. I wanted to be true. I wanted to be hopeful but honest. And I think in attempting hope with honesty, I give you the ending that you will all get when you read the novel.
Very well said. Now, when Sister Fina is faced with deportation, one of her fears is to be sent back and she'll be killed because of what she said in the past, and you go into that Sri Lanka and Australia are allies and everything's great now and you're not allowed to talk about the war. And it kind of struck me there's a meta story there, because you are doing that. The novel is sometimes quite graphic about what happens in Sri Lanka. You don't spare Sri Lanka. It's no rosy, this is where my parents came from, and this is mate. You do not spare Sri Lanka.
Yeah, it's not about the mangoes and the monsoons
No.
and the beaches.
Writing that, were you worried? Two things. One, do you worry about that? Is that a real worry for someone in your community to write about? And of course, here in Australia, I assume, you know, there are Tamils and also Sinhalese. Was that something you thought about? How your book would be received by the wider Sri Lankan community? Were they factors you were thinking?
No. Usually because, I mean, for the first 10 drafts, certainly for the first draft, I'm just thinking about the writing. So once I get past my incredible agony, imposter syndrome and anxiety, which I'm currently in the throes of because I've just started my new novel, after that initial horrible period, then it just becomes about the story. So I'm really just writing into the story, and that's all I can think about. The children are lucky if they get fed. And it's a really obsessive period in which I become very difficult to be with until I get to the end of the story. And then I go back and I edit, right? And then I will think about audiences or the reader, but not specifically in relation to their ethnicity, in particular whether they're Sinhalese and how they'll feel about it, or Sri Lanka. Because I'm writing to be honest, and I'm writing from my perspective, which is that of a Sri Lankan Tamil who's also Australian. And there's three parts to that and many more subparts to that. And so my first responsibility is to the honesty of the story. When I do a panel or a festival or a talk, if I recognise that there are Sinhalese people in the audience, so that's the majority ethnic group within Sri Lanka, and I'm from the ethnic minority, I do wonder how the novel lands with them. I do, because I think it's impossible and naive not to wonder, it's insensitive not to wonder how it lands with them. And I'm open to having conversations about that contested political history, both past and actually our contemporary, what's happening at the moment. And at the same time, in Sri Lanka, for example, the history that's asserted is very much a particular version of history. And the Tamil story and stories, because there are many, about what happened in the past, what happened during the war, and how things are right now, are often ignore or deliberately erase that Tamil experience. And as a Tamil, I feel a sense of responsibility to advocate for that experience and those stories, plural. In relation to Sri Lanka itself, so I would never go back during a Rajapaksa government. So we basically switched between two governments in Sri Lanka, two political parties, and the one particular political party that was mostly responsible for the genocide, I just wouldn't go back during that time. More than anything, just because I can't sit with them in power and be in the country at that time. I don't think that an Australian who holds an Australian passport and a British passport is likely to be a political target in that environment. Like, I don't think that even they are that stupid. And I don't think that they've necessarily even read the book. So, because Sri Lanka, it's Anglophone, but it's also Sinhalese and it's also Tamil. So people are speaking different languages. And so effectively, I'm a diasporic writer writing in English from outside the country. So I don't think that I am at risk or a target. That said, I always let the British High Commission and the Australian High Commission know when I'm coming.
It's really interesting that it goes to what the book does. It says, these are these characters, they're Australian, but they bring all these other stories. So here you talk about that, oh, I wouldn't go back to that country in under this government. It's interesting because things that I don't think about, but it's really interesting to get that perspective. I want to jump a little bit away from the actual book and the story, but more a bit around the process of writing, if we can jump over to that. And obviously, I want to talk about, you know, you've received, I'd say, what's probably the greatest recognition an Australian writer can receive. And I'm wondering how your life's changed since you were the answer to a pub trivia question. And I believe you're also the answer to a trivia in a newspaper.
Yeah, crossword. So cool.
But it goes to my actual question, of course, is in the... I have read the acknowledgements, and I think you, maybe to your publisher, you say the MFFA, which I think refers to the Miles Franklin Award with an extra F, which probably means freaking or flipping. Since you've won that, I'm not so concerned how your life's changed. How's your writing changed? Is that a weight? Is it? How do you manage that? Because you've achieved enormous popularity. You're also the hardest working author in Australia. Everywhere you're working hard, and I think you're also holding down a corporate job as well. But how does that award affect the writing? And is it a case of, to paraphrase a Murdoch saying, awards are terrible things until you have one? Could you discuss that for us?
Okay. Yeah, wow. So this was an incredible award to win. I really... And I still get that moment, Ryan, where I think Sophie was talking about the Miles Franklin winner, and I am literally almost going... Like, I'm looking behind me to see who's here, because I still have a moment of disconnect with it. And I appreciate it's been 13 months and I should really get over it. And Alexis Wright is probably totally comfortable with it and very calm about having won two awards, not one. But, you know, for me, it was a really, really big deal. And it has been... It's an incredible honour. And it has, for my writing life... I was so lucky in that I wrote Safe Haven before I was even nominated for the award. So I wrote it as soon as I handed the manuscript of Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens to the publisher, to Robert, my publisher, thinking, you know, that I was never going to get a publishing contract for it, that it would never be published. Handed it over and said, look, Robert, I'm going to start writing my next one. This is what I think it's about. What do you think? And we had a bit of a chat and away... You go, right? You just sort of walk away, get into your daytime pajamas and start writing. And so I didn't think about anything. And I hadn't been shortlisted or longlisted for any award for Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens. And so I just thought, it's not an award-winning novel, and that's okay. I didn't write it to win awards. An award would be lovely. And so I kept writing Safe Haven with completely free of any burden, weight, self-consciousness or readers being aware of me. And it was lovely with Chai Time at Cinnamon Gardens because it was actually selling copies outside my circle of friends and family. And
That's always the goal.
Oh my God, isn't it just? Like, I mean, I'm seriously only related to one person in the audience today, and this is remarkable because normally it's full of my people because I'm relying on them. And so it's been, it's really changed the profile of the book, of the storytelling, of the backlist. The backlist is now coming to the front as well, which is wonderful to see. Because each time I wrote a novel, when I finished a manuscript, I would always just whisper quietly into the ear of the manuscript to please be the book that brought Song of the Sun God home. Because Song of the Sun God was my first book, and it was really my love letter to my ancestors and to my children. And it was my way of recording the injustices of what had happened to our people. But it had been, it was really sequestered and stuck in Sri Lanka. I'd never been able to find a publisher in Australia. And at the time, some 10 years ago, it wasn't considered Australian enough to be published here. So at the end of writing every manuscript, I kid you not, I whisper into its ear and I will say, please, please be the novel. Please be the one to bring Song of the Sun God home, because this is my home and this is where I want it to be published. And so Chai Time at Cinema Gardens really did that for Song of the Sun God. And then the Miles Franklin did that for everything. And Safe Haven was out, or was ready. It was with Robert before, you know, the award was announced. And so it's created or opened up so many opportunities for me and things to do and places to go, people to meet. And I'm like super introverted, would, you know, much prefer to be at home writing a novel. At a certain point become really socially awkward, usually in the first 30 seconds of a conversation. And so it's, you know, this is not my comfort zone. And yet I love to talk about books, any book at all, and I love to connect with readers. And so there has been a huge amount of that incredible relationship building. And at the same time, as you know, all writers want to do is write. That's all we want to do. We just want to write.
And win awards.
Oh, that's huge. But yeah, really just write. And so I have really struggled to find the time to write and the headspace. And I have had to, I recently asked my employer, my corporate employer, to give me a different job at the place of employment because I'm not ready to break completely with that other job that all writers have. So I've changed jobs so that I have a completely different role, which is half as much time required. Yeah. So I've effectively asked to be demoted, and that's really frightening to me, right? I had to call my dad and say, look, Upper, this is what the spreadsheet looks like, and what do you think, right? And my dad was so sweet. He said, you know, you work for two reasons. One is to provide for your children, and the other is to give you that sense of aspiration and purpose. And I can see that writing gives you that sense of purpose, so you should do it. So he's a pretty good dad.
How do your parents feel? I was thinking about, when I was reading the book, I was thinking about my family. They came in the 1890s and 1920s as Italians. They were Sicilians, the scum of Europe at the time. They had to assimilate. They had to blend in. You had to keep your head down. And I was thinking, what do your parents think? I assume they would have went through the same situation. They arrive here, you keep your head down, you work hard, you try to be a good migrant, and then you come along and just blow the doors off the place. Let's chat about detention centres, everybody. Yeah. How's that gone down with your parents?
Yeah, they're funny. So they're really, really proud. My mother is quite a typical Sri Lankan Tamil woman in that, you know, she really does not want her head above the parapet. So it took some getting used to for her that if you know us well, you would see so much of my own family in the novels. And so the revelations that are there are not necessarily apparent to you, but they are apparent to her. And so she was understandably uncomfortable with that, and at the same time so proud. And proud to see, you know, my father will say at the end of a novel, he'll say, oh, so you were listening. And you know, it's such high praise from him because so much of my literature draws on our culture and our heritage and our religion and politics and struggle and food, family, our values. It's all in there. And so they're really proud to have that elevated and proud to see it not just sort of be read by our own community, but to be read more widely, to seek connect with communities that are not Sri Lankan Tamil. So I'll get a lot of people that are from different backgrounds saying to me, this is like my father's story, this is like my story, and this is what it was like for us. And it makes me feel that we're all part of the same community. You know, we are different, but we're also the same.
Yeah, it's very much a story of migration and finding home, which is applicable to, as you said, we're all migrants apart from First Nations. You mentioned how so much of the literature is in your identity, cultural identity. Is that limiting to some point, or is it liberating?
Sorry,
because I just noticed in the articles that they've been written about you, you're the Sri Lankan Australian writer, Shankari, but you're just a writer. These stories are universal.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm definitely going to write erotic fiction at some point in the future. In fact, Christine and I are going to do it together.
How's that going to go with mum and dad?
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure, well, never mind. Sri Lankans are very conservative. And so, you know, for example, I think this has been in the newspaper, where my parents would test me on the different parts of the body for biology, but completely miss the part of the body from here to here. What was the question again?
Is it limiting having that?
Yeah, not at all. No.
Do you feel you can go out and you can write what you want to write and do what you want to do? Or is it actually liberating that you've got this great, rich canvas to explore?
Yeah. So I think as I have progressed as a writer, I felt a lot more confident within myself and a lot more, a lot less concerned about publishing and more interested in the story that's actually speaking to me, or the story that I want to tell, or the issue that I'm really angry about, because most of my novels actually do start from rage. And so what is it that I'm angry about? What is it that I care about? And how is that story best served? And it's, so there's not so much as a consciousness to it. At the same time, my normal is Sri Lankan Tamil Australian, or Australian Sri Lankan Tamil, or just Tamil, or sometimes lots of white people, right? My day is, it's a mix of everything. And that's my normal, and that's what I write about, and that's what I want to share with people. And so it's not that I'm choosing or even limited by or emancipated by. It's just that I write what I see. I write what I feel, what I care about, and what I want to connect with you over.
You've said it's loosely based on a number of incidents, but Billawilla family. And I'm wondering, why fiction? Because you could have written a great non-fiction, a Helen Garner type book on that case. What did fiction give you that non-fiction wouldn't have given you? Or, I mean, maybe it wasn't even a choice, maybe again it was just a natural thing, but if you thought about it, because you could base it on that, be a great story, really interesting story, really relevant, but you chose to fictionalise it, and I'm just wondering what those choices are.
Yeah, for sure. Great question. I think it's that is the lived experience of a really beautiful family, and it's their lived experience. And so if and when they want to talk about it, and they have, they've written, Priya has written her story with with one of the advocates that she worked with, and it's a really powerful story. And that's their story to tell. So the non-fiction of it is their story to tell. And I was, you know, we have family members that know them and speak to them regularly, and I was very careful about not wanting to engage with them because it is their story. And I wanted to use some of those moments that are universal to their story, to the Apollo Bay story, to the Rural Australians for Refugees, and then use it to springboard into fiction and to take the narrative arc of that story of Safe Haven in a completely different direction from the Billawilla story and from the Apollo Bay story, even though the emotional catalyst for it is them. And it was not my story to tell.
Have they read it?
Well, Priya hasn't. I don't think Priya's read it, but I have sent her a box of books, and we've spoken a few times, and she was very, very happy to receive the box of books and amazed that anyone would want to write fiction about her story. And then, because she is who she is, she moved very quickly into advocacy and started to give me lists of all the things that we need to do next. So I was like, okay, I need to now just take a break. And but she's really very inspirational, right? She's not just advocating for herself, she's advocating for other people, and she doesn't stop.
Even though it's not nonfiction, huge amount of research, and I think I thought, oh, one of the really difficult things you did was you took us inside a detention centre. And then I thought, actually, maybe that's quite clever because I don't know what one would look like inside. Not many people would. What was your research around getting that right? Because if you don't get that right, it just becomes cliche. Yeah. Very easy to write a cliche detention centre off an island in Australia. Can you take us into the research, how you approached that and what you did to try to get that right?
Yeah. So there are an extraordinary amount of memoirs, testimony, witness statements and human rights reports about what detention centres are like. And if you go looking for them, you can find them really easily. And this was interesting to me. I particularly liked the memoir and witness statement approaches because it's those are very much in the voice of people that have survived those places, as opposed to the voices of their lawyers or their caseworkers. And I think what I found fascinating was that sense of it's all out there. If we wanted to read it, and this is not a rebuke, right? This is absolutely not a rebuke. This is the challenge for fiction, and this is the challenge for storytellers, that so much of this information is already out there. How do we make it accessible to you? Because it is accessible. You just Google search it. But how do we create that connection between the story and the people that we want to listen to the story and care about the story and think about the story? And so that's the challenge for all of us as storytellers. And so in answer to your nonfiction versus fiction, for me, fiction is something that is very powerful. I think it's a very powerful tool. It moves me immensely. You know, I am more likely to remember and empathize with and stay with the experiences of a family in a country through a novel about that country than I am through a human rights report. And I say this as someone who for a living has to read human rights reports. And so I wanted to use fiction in that way and for that reason. And so it was largely through desktop research. I'm very fortunate in clients, contacts, colleagues and friends. And the other thing that I do, which is going to sound crazy, but I'll tell you anyway, is that when people ask me, what do? I will say I'm writing a novel about about an offshore detention centre. And it'll be like, as soon as I get into an Uber, you know, I'm writing a novel about an offshore detention centre. Hi. And you'd be amazed at how many stories and how much information people have about places, to the point where I once caught an Uber from the BCF store in Townsville. So I work for Super Retail Group that owns BCF. So it was at a BCF store in Townsville. The Uber driver from BCF to Townsville Airport was an engineer at Nauru, at the detention centre in Nauru. So we stopped at the Uber at the airport, and because I like to get to the airport like 2 hours early, we had a whole 40 minutes parked while he just told me everything he knew. And it was fascinating because it was like the universe was just saying, let me help you a little bit, because I can see that your desktop research has hit a dead end. And, you know, we have friends, we know people who work in offshore detention centres, and they're not allowed to talk to you. They've signed NDAs, right? They're not allowed to talk to you. So I can't go to my friends and say, tell me what you know. I mean, I've tried, but they won't. But here was an Uber driver that had been an engineer on the centre telling me things that I needed to know. So,
well, that's incredibly lucky. It is a serendipity of the universe. But that doesn't explain the extensive page on Norwegian wool. Where did that come from?
Google is an amazing thing. Can you imagine how
hard it was to get? Where did the idea to include that in the story? There's a very extensive piece about the vagaries of Norwegian wool, which is completely fascinating. But how have you thought? It was brilliant. It was one of that moment of levity. And I'm thinking, how did you come up with that? And yeah, where did you get that information from?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I enjoyed that bit. I enjoyed it. And I enjoy Norwegians because there's a really big Sri Lankan Tamil community in Norway. My grandmother on my father's side lived the last years of her life in Norway, so I spent a lot of time in Bergen, which is why I know about Bergen. Yeah. And so often in novels, and the Norwegian captain is based on the captain that picked up the Apollo Bay family. So a Norwegian captain picks up a boat that's sinking. Everyone else had ignored the distress call. He picks up the boat, rescues a gentleman called Para Pahir, who goes to an offshore detention center, who becomes friends with a grandmother in Apollo Bay, who helps him start his life over. And that lady is Ali Cork, who's now my auntie Ali Cork. And so I wanted to honor that Norwegian captain. And I like to do what's called Easter egging in writing, which is where you Easter egg things that have a connection to somebody that you know or care about. And so some of that Norwegian stuff is
Easter egg. What's the Easter egging? I'm not familiar with that.
So the concept of an Easter egg?
But how does that relate to the...
To Norway?
No. How you said you're Easter egging? I didn't...
Yeah, so I'm Easter egging things like the particular berry coolie is a particular berry coolie that my cousin has made for me. So it's an Easter egg just for her. Yeah, so Norwegian salmon, Norwegian vitamin D, is based on a documentary that a cousin made me watch about how great Norwegian vitamin D is. I was like, okay, this is really boring as bad shit. But it turns out that it's useful if you want your really quirky Norwegian captain to wax lyrical about the value of Norwegian wool and the extraction of vitamin D from it.
He was a very realistic character. So you're writing the Sri Lankan character is great, but then you have this really, really, now that it's explained, a very realistic Norwegian captain in there.
Yeah, I mean, and you end up meeting people, right, as you travel. I'm pretty old, like I'm 50, and not old, but you know what I mean. You know what I mean, right? I've lived many years now, and I'm grateful for all of those years. And what that means is that in the course of all of those years, I meet people, and I find people to be incredibly generous in wanting to tell you everything from how to extract lanolin from wool and why Norwegian sheep are not as good as Australian sheep, you know, to how it is that, you know, you would remove a brain tumour, or in the case of Sister Fina, how one sews parts of a body during a war. And so you learn and you remember and...
The detail makes it. The specificity makes it. I've got an eye on the clock. I think we've got 45 seconds. I've got one last question. Of all the things you could be doing, spending time with your family, working, sitting on a beach, more profitable things you could be doing, why do you write?
It's not because I'm committed to the living wage, obviously. I write because I can't not write. I write because I actually don't. I'm not sure that I know how not to write. I'm not myself when I'm not writing, and I am most myself when I am writing. And it's a real, it feels like a gift that the universe gives to all of us, that capacity for expression and storytelling and that love of words and the creation of characters. And so the answer is I don't know how not to write.
I think that's a perfect answer to end on. Thank you very much. I'll say again, I really, really, really enjoyed it because it was another part of Australia that I wouldn't have known about. And I don't mean the detention centres, but I mean you bring your culture and your history and Sri Lankan history to the page, and I think it opens up really important conversations. I imagine there's conversations happening around Australia about how we treat people, how people come to Australia, what that means, what it means for them, what it means for us. And I think that's the importance of a book like this, that it's going to open up these spaces for people that probably haven't had much of a voice in Australian fiction for a long time. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
A huge thank you to Shankari and Ryan for sharing such a wonderful conversation. SMSA members can borrow Safe Haven from our library on level 2, or you can purchase this book from your local bookstore. We've left a link to our friends at Abby's Bookshop in the accompanying text. Thank you to all those who joined us at the event, making up our amazing live audience, and to you at home for listening. I hope you enjoyed listening to this author conversation, and keep an eye out on our website for our latest event recordings.